Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. My guest today is Dr. Jim Shields, a senior ecologist with more than 30 years' experience in wildlife management. His main job for the last 15 years has been to design ways to successfully manage fauna and flora for the state forests of New South Wales in Australia, a government trading enterprise which manages 2 million hectares or 5 million acres of native and planted forests. Jim also works in a variety of academic and government institutions to teach and to provide scientific advice about natural resource management in general and wildlife management in particular. Jim Shields has worked within agriculture, forestry, road construction and the hospitality industries in a variety of capacities. His common sense approach to wildlife management has been applied most recently in Australia, but his experience and ecological knowledge extend to North and South America, the UK and Northern Europe, Southeast Asia and Japan. Dr. Jim Shields, welcome to If You Love This Planet.
It's an honor to be here, Helen.
Now, Jim, you're from Kansas.
Yes, I am.
I want you to explain to the audience how the hell you got from Kansas. Well, first of all, what did you do in Kansas? And then how did you get from Kansas to Australia?
I'd be most happy to talk about that, and there's some interesting current events about my hometown.
I was
actually born in Amarillo, Texas.
Oh, right, where they store the plutonium pits for nuclear weapons.
Exactly. Northern part of Texas, not all that far from Kansas. My father was living there at the time in his occupation as a cattle buyer, a stock and station agent. But unfortunately, he passed away shortly after I was born, and my mother moved back to the ancestral home in eastern Kansas, where I grew up in a tiny town, Reading, Kansas. Spelled Reading, but named after the town in England called Reading. And that's where I've spent my first 18 years growing up on a farm and in a very small town. And we had a wheat and cattle property, a little house in the town, and I grew up in circumstances much like you see on television in the good old days. And I think I may be one of the last people who actually lived in a town like Mayberry, where Andy of Mayberry made the show.
Right. So now, okay, so what were your academic achievements, what academic studies did you do before you came to Australia? In other words, what is your background, Jim?
Yep. Studies that I did, I originally thought I wanted to be a veterinary, and I did pre-vet at Kansas State University. Due to circumstances, we had no money. I went on a scholarship, and once I got there, I discovered two things. One, that veterinary science was much like farming and involved getting kicked by large domestic animals. I was much more interested in wildlife, and I switched into one of the first ecology degrees.
Okay, so and were you employed in Kansas before you came to Australia, and how long ago did you move to Australia?
Yep. I was indeed employed in a variety of things. I had to work to get through university, and I spent a fair bit of time as a chef and eventually bought into a restaurant and worked in the hospitality industry there. I worked in a road construction crew. I ran a Caterpillar loader dozer building I-70, and ended up I was spending 8 or 9 months working in a beef processing plant, reducing beef to 8 boxes in about 3 minutes.
Oh my God!
Yes.
And then when did you start doing your, you know, apply your academic work to what you're interested in?
To the world?
Yeah.
I was, that was when I came to Australia.
Why did you come to Australia?
I have 3 different answers for that. The short one that I give when people aren't really interested, and I say I was just looking for a good time. And that's true. I was 26, and I was looking to have a bit of an adventure in the world.
Right.
The second reason I came was academic and scientific. I had got into wildlife biology, particularly field ornithology, and I wanted to do some original research. And I found that most of the really cool stuff had been done by somebody else 30 years before in North America. And so I wanted to work on Australian birds in particular, and had a bit of an opportunity. And the third reason, Helen, is really something that I don't tell a lot of people because it's pretty complex, but it's relevant to If You Love This Planet, because I, early on, did some very basic calculations about population and figured out that the human population would expand exponentially during my sainted lifetime. And I really like nature, and I'm fairly selfish. I like a comfortable lifestyle. And I went about an analysis of the best place to live my life. And what I did was look at places around the world which produced more food than they consumed, which had a relatively stable social system, and which had a language that I could either speak or learn fairly quickly. And because of circumstances, I also threw in weather. I had just, as well as doing the meat packing in a refrigerated factory over the winter, I was working as a wilderness guide above snowline in the summer at that point, and I was tired of being cold. I'd been cold for 3 years solid. Yeah,
fair enough. Well, that's very fascinating, Jim. Now, I want to explain to the audience how I met Jim Shields, Dr. Jim Shields. It's an interesting story, but we have, I've got a property, 7 acres, in a little fishing village on the south coast of New South Wales, and we have a lot of native birds around. And one of the native birds is called the bell minor or the bellbird, and it goes bing, bing, bing all day, and I've always loved the bellbird. But it turns out that bellbirds move in flocks, and they take over a territory, and they're very territorial, and they any other birds that enter into their territory, they dive bomb them and frighten them away. Even big kookaburras or eagles or whatever turns up, they usually can frighten the birds away. And so we don't have many other birds, and I didn't like this. And even though these bell miners were indigenous, I didn't want them around frightening away the other birds. So I got on the telephone and I found the person most likely to be able to help was this man, Dr. Jim Shields, and it turns out he's from Kansas City. And so Jim came up and we had a fascinating time. He used to get up at dawn, put the ghost nets across where the birds sort of lived, and they would wake up the birds and fly into the ghost nets, and he would catch lots of birds, including what he called bycatch, which were other beautiful birds, which he would then measure, weigh, and put bands on their legs and free them up. And he did other things to the bellbirds that he caught. and the bellbird population did decrease, and we did get lots of other birds. But in the interim, I found out about Dr. Jim Shields. I've got some very specific questions for you today, Jim.
Yes.
I We live in the most beautiful place, and there's a sort of cathedral of trees as you enter Bermagui. They're called spotted gums. They're eucalyptus, and they hang over the road like tall galleons. They're gorgeous things. And the forestry department, which is run by the state of New South Wales, is in there chopping these trees down. Now, I'm sorry, I'm giving a little lecture, but Australian trees tend to be the most compact, best compactors of carbon of any trees in the world. And these trees are being chopped down, sent by lorry down to a factory about an hour south of us. They're wood chipped and sent to Japan to be made into paper, which really riles me, because one of the ways we can help to reverse global warming is to leave these trees intact. And it takes a tree 500 years to trap the carbon. So if you plant new trees, it doesn't really help much with carbon. And you release all the carbon by turning them into paper, and the paper gets burnt. Jim, you were employed by the forestry department, were you not, to look after the birds and the fauna. Is that correct?
That is indeed. That was my job, Helen.
Okay, so what's your take on this really vile, primitivistic behavior of these people who are chopping down our future?
Well, I always like the way you get stuck straight into a topic.
Well, you may as well.
That's right. May as well wade right in.
Yeah, wade right in.
And fair enough. That's how things get explored and explained.
Yeah.
But my take on it is based on a lot of experience and a lot of thought, and it is not one that I came to lightly in the end.
Okay.
First thing you might wonder is how I came to be working for these vile people.
Yep.
Why would a relatively nice person, one would think, work for any sort of industry like that?
Yep.
The short answer to that is, if I won't do it, who will? If I, as a scientist and a honest person, won't work for these industries which are going on and try and make things as good as they can be, then it's a cycle of bad people making bad decisions.
Okay, so I accept that. So, mm-hmm. In fact, what did your job involve? What good did you do and can do?
I'm happy to talk about that, because what I tried to do and what I did fairly successfully up until I retired, I should say that I've retired 4 years ago on medical grounds, and what I say is what I'm saying and nothing whatsoever to do with the forestry of New South Wales. I'm certainly not being an advocate for that organization at the moment. But what I did was devise ways of harvesting trees in the least harmful manner with regard to wildlife, and setting up a set of rules based on science that could be read and understood by anyone and are enforced by another independent government department. My friends in the National Parks and Wildlife Service are the enforcers. And although, as you say, the trees are being cut down, it's not a pretty sight. I always say it's harder to sell logging on a recently logged area than it is to sell a lamb chop in an abattoir. It doesn't look good. But if they are going to be harvested, it's done in the best possible manner with regard to the conservation of flora and fauna.
Okay, now let's get on to the koalas. We used to have lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of koalas in this area of Australia, and now they're endangered, and in fact there is evidence that there are still some koalas down, but the forestry department is chopping the trees down and destroying the habitat. And one thing that koalas can't stand, because they're territorial, is their habitat being destroyed. Would you like to comment on that, Jim Shields?
I would be more than happy to, Helen. First off, the koalas being rare, and it is certainly true that koalas in this part of the world that is southeast New South Wales, the coastal part. Koalas are very uncommon, particularly our particularly beautiful place, the Bega Valley. You put forward that this is in some way related to forestry operations, and it might be, but historically, one has to look at the land use and what koala habitat used to be, what it is, and why the koalas got so rare. Koalas are grazing animals, as most people know, or foliovores, eat the leaves of eucalypts, casuarinas, and melaleucas, and that's all. And their life is centered around getting nutritious food, as you would understand as a doctor. All they get is vegetables, and they need to get the most proteinaceous vegetables. They select for habitat that is directly related to the nutrients in the soil. And in this part of the world, the soils are very poor, except for the Bega Valley woodlands, which is where the abundant koala populations were. At present, the woodlands are now paddocks on which graze black and white cows, which provide the milk for Bega cheese. All the habitat that was really, really good was selected for by the farmers in the same manner that the koalas did, on the basis of its nutrients. Mm. So that occurred between, this area was settled relatively early. It started to be cleared in the 1820s, and the clearing of the valley was more or less complete by the 1960s.
Mm. Tragic.
Yes, it was.
And also, I believe that, you know, the early settlers in Australia used to go around and shoot the koalas. They used to call them monkeys. And they used to skin them and send hundreds of thousands of koala skins to America to be turned into fur coats and the like, right?
Aviators' jackets. Was a primary use for them.
Oh.
And this is relevant to the question of why they are so rare around here at the moment.
Yeah.
In that during the 1930s, while the dairy industry was expanding and clearing more and more of the woodland, there was a factory established at the little town of Wyndham, just near us, to process rabbit and koala skin.
Oh, my God.
And going through the economic records of the time, it appears that at least 100 and probably up to 300,000 koala skins were processed there at the koala.
Oh, that makes me feel so sick. How long does a koala live? What's its lifespan, Jim Shields?
Depends on where you are, but they become reproductive at about 5, the females do. Mm. They're the only important ones in population terms, and continue reproducing until they're 10 to 11, should they live that long.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Their lifespan's only about 10 years?
Yes.
That's very short, isn't it?
Not too short in the animal world, and I'm talking about in the wild. In captivity, they can live up to double that time.
Right. I want people to know that koalas are not bears. They're marsupials. They have a pouch, and they carry their young around in their pouch. And when the young get a bit older, they run around on their mother's shoulder. And, of course, koalas spend all their time in the trees, and they're absolutely beautiful creatures. And their fur is so soft, and if you bury your nose in their fur, they smell of eucalyptus oil, don't they, Jim?
They do indeed.
Oh, they're lovely.
Yeah.
I want you now to talk to the people about our birds, Jim. I have learnt so much from you about our wonderful, unique Australian birds. Can you give us a little soliloquy about the birds?
I can indeed. But I have two more things about the koalas.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Hopefully it makes a bit of a complete story.
Yeah.
We had the habitat is pretty much dairy cow habitat now. Had a big mortality event for adults with the harvesting for furs.
Yes.
And then in 1952, a fire swept this entire region, and it was devastating. Oh. It killed four people in the town of Biga. It burnt the town of Eden more or less to the ground, and my friend there can remember going down to hide in a boat to get away from the fire with her mother. And, of course, this was not very nice for the koalas as well.
No.
Now, and we had three events that occurred here in rapid succession, and it resulted in the koalas being quite rare. They're confined to a habitat that is not really good for them, and they have very large territories. And so they're hard to find and hard to study because people quite logically usually study koalas where they're common and not where they're rare. So this is the forest industry does with regard to logging. I know it's been an unpleasant experience for the people of Bermagui, where it's nominated koala habitat. The commission has logged it, as they're more or less required to do in the terms of the regional forest agreement. And the result is a forest that is going to be much younger.
Yeah. Well, I just want to say... I just want to say, as an environmentalist, and I know you are too, Jim, that the only thing that all the countries of the world agreed on at the Copenhagen conference 2 years ago was that all the trees should be left intact in the world because it's the trees that contain the carbon, and they trap the carbon dioxide and they help to reverse global warming. And we, Australia, pay millions of dollars to Indonesia and New Guinea to help them stop chopping down their native forest. Yet we're doing it, and we've got to stop it, Jim. We've got to stop it. We can't. I don't even know what the forestry agreement was originally, but we're selling our we're virtually giving our trees to Japan. And I want to know, did we years ago, the federal government, do a deal with Japan? If you buy our iron ore and you buy our uranium, we'll give you our trees, because we don't even make any money from chopping the trees down. I can't tell you how much this sticks in my craw as a physician, an environmentalist. Why are they doing it? And there is a motto in Australia: if it moves, shoot it, and if it doesn't, chop it down. And that's where I think these characters, these men, are coming from. Is that true?
No, I would say very much so that it's not. I understand perfectly your position, and also the Copenhagen agreement that trees in the ground are good. And one of the main things about that was that third world countries can get value from leaving their trees standing, just like they can from growing trees for carbon credits. The deal about harvesting trees in Australia, I will say this: if growing and harvesting native forests in perpetuity, with due regard for their flora and fauna, isn't a sustainable exercise, what possibly could be?
No, but you see, it's sustainable in terms of 500 years, because it takes a tree 500 years to regain and retrap that carbon. And so things are so grim now in terms of global warming. And now the scientists are saying, the international climate scientists are saying, you know, we may increase the temperature of the planet by 4 degrees. I mean, things are so grim. We have to look at this with more of an acute emergency situation, like the planet's in the intensive care unit, and we can't look at things the way we used to look at things, Jim. It's different now.
It is indeed, Helen. You're exactly right. I strongly agree with the point you just made. With regard to the cutting down of the trees, I'm a pragmatist. I like to succeed at things. In pragmatic terms, tomorrow people are not going to stop using paper and paper products. Is that right?
Well, I I would like to disagree with that. If people are educated, you can get them to do things for their own good and the good of their children. And I wrote a book called If You Love This Planet, actually in 92, and I did a big lecture tour of America.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, you're not to blow your nose on trees anymore. You've got to blow your nose on handkerchiefs, which will last you for the rest of your life. And you know, you're allowed to use toilet paper, okay, although the Indians don't.
Yes.
But you're not to use paper towels in the kitchen. You're not to use paper serviettes. You need to use cloth napkins, which you can use for the rest of your life, and the like. And a lot of people did take that seriously. And I believe if you educate people, Jim, about the consequences of not doing the right thing, and they very often will do the right thing, but the only way to get the majority of people on board, of course, is through the media, and that means access to the media, which, if you look at the media now in terms of Murdoch et al., things are somewhat grim. But so I'm a pragmatist, but in terms of an altruistic perspective, in terms of trying to make sure life on the planet continues, I guess that's where I'm coming from.
Yes, and I agree with the point of education being the way forward, and that people, if they understand the true importance of the issue, will behave and take that on board and take action.
Yeah.
However, is not going to happen tomorrow. In the next 2 or 3 years, even. Education is a long process. And B, a lot of people don't have access or knowledge or any way to acquire that information and will be driven by market forces.
Yeah, I know, but they would if the media accepted its responsibility. But that's another whole issue, because I want to get onto birds now.
And we'll do the birds.
And my great-grandfather was called Bronowski, because my name really is Helen Bronowski, Polish, and he was a Polish immigrant to Australia, and he drew all the birds of Australia, rather like Audubon in America.
Yep.
But so when you came to our house and you started showing us all these incredible birds, little delicate things, and the way you handled them and what you did with them, and told me all about their calls and their natural habitat and their... It was so fascinating. So as an American from Kansas City coming here, you've been here a long time, I know, but what strikes you most about our indigenous birds, which are unique and to the whole world?
Yeah.
Or in the whole world, yeah.
In the whole world, they are indeed. That uniqueness is fascinating, but... Two things. One is their diversity, and the number of different kinds of them there are, and they're exceptionally beautiful and bright colors and songs.
Mm.
It is noticeable when I go back to the Northern Hemisphere that, lovely though the birds are, if you go to the forest, you have to look really hard to see some little brown birds. And listen really hard to get to know their calls.
Mm.
They're at your place, the lovely forest at moonrise. Step out on that veranda, and you're assaulted by beautiful, beautiful birds. Bright red and green parrots, the size of a house pigeon, eating at your bird feeder. The pigeons. Great diversity of unique birds that have wonderful, wonderful plumage and wonderful songs. You asked me what struck me. That's the first, and the aesthetic thing about it. And I will tell you quite truly, one of the big reasons I came to Australia along the science lines I talked was from looking at the books and seeing the blue wrens.
Oh. Describe the blue wrens.
The blue wren, for your international listeners, is just incredible. It does look a little bit like a wren. It's not as related to the Northern Hemisphere wrens. But it's brilliant blue. The males below the chest and on their shoulders have this iridescent blue that's contrasted with black wing bars and a black facial pattern that looks like it was designed by a fashionista. Our friend Prue would be happy to, I think, to have designed many of the colors. And they go about in small parties, and they're noisy and friendly. As it turns out, have an they were the subject of study, and they found out that they're exceptionally social. They have helpers at the nest. The generation before, the young from that generation, helped them raise the next generation. The second striking thing about Australian birds is their toughness and adaptability to a very harsh and random climate. And they live for a long time. Those little blue wrens, one of the objects of my studies and doing the banding, like we do at your place, is to see how long the birds live. And Australian little birds live an incredibly long time. They would live as long as the koalas. I've recorded blue wrens, which we actually should call fairy wrens. There is the name in the book. I've recorded them living at least 8 years in my own data from banding I've done, and I think their record life is close to 15 years.
Jim, it's only the male bird that turn this incredibly iridescent sapphire blue in the spring and summer when they're mating, and then in the winter, don't they go back to their sort of gray black plumage?
Yes, they do.
And the other thing I read about blue wrens is that they're almost just one large or two large testicles, in that the males reproduce like crazy with lots of different females. Is that correct during the mating season?
Oh, yes.
Tell us about it.
It is this complex social system that's set up so you can get through the lean times, but the males take every opportunity to keep their genetic stock going, and they mate with all of the females that they can get access to in their region, or in their region. They have a territory of about 5 hectares,
right.
About 12 of the old acres for this group. It's a group territory. And if he can, the male will impregnate all of the females in his group, and they will be cared for by this next generation of helpers at the nest.
Well, now, one female, does she lay only one set of eggs in a season, or can she do it twice?
What I was saying about the Australian birds, their adaptability and toughness.
Yeah.
They can keep laying eggs and having young as long as the conditions are good.
Really?
Yep.
How long does it take for an egg to incubate and get the babies?
It's amazingly regular amongst birds. It's between 15 days and 22 days.
Really?
Yep.
And after impregnation, how long does it take for the female to lay the egg?
About a day.
Only a day, and she'll lay an egg. Wow.
Yeah.
That's quick, isn't it? It's much faster than a female human.
Yes. Yep. It is. It's a lot of hard work all at once.
Yes.
And for the body, and then there's a period of care afterwards. You've got to lay a clutch of eggs, usually 4 to 5, so it takes 4 to 5 days to lay the clutch, and about 3 weeks to incubate them, and they're hatched out, and they hatch out Usually passerine perching birds come out naked and defenseless. So, but they grow just as rapidly as the females produce the
eggs.
And
what do they eat insects, those fairy wrens?
Those fairy wrens are spider specialists.
Oh, they eat spiders?
Yes.
Well, that's good, because people need to know that Australia has the most noxious spiders in the world, and we have the most poisonous snakes in the world. So if you're coming here, you have to be careful. And the other thing I want to ask you, Jim Shields, is we've just got some new birds that have turned up at our feeding tray, and they're brown cuckoo doves, and they're incredibly tame. They just sit. They're all fluffed up, and they're beautiful sort of brown iridescent big birds. Tell us about them, because I don't know about these birds.
Yes, and they are interesting and a Australian phenomena.
Yeah.
They're part of the group known as rainforest or fruit pigeons.
Yes.
And they eat, most Australian trees and plants produce hard seeds.
Mm.
Rainforest trees produce soft fruits.
Mm.
And these pigeons have adapted to make their living off of them. And they, consequently, their lifestyle is a bit up and down. If the rainforest fruits are on big, then everything is good and they have heaps and heaps of young. They produce really quickly, reproduce really quickly, and so the birds that you are seeing, I would wager, are juveniles that have been hatched out after this bit of good rain we've had over the past year, and their parents have thrown them out and are raising another group.
And they're very tame. They just sit there, and they're not scared. They remind me of the birds on the Galapagos Islands where, you know, you can step over them sitting on their nests. They have absolutely no fear of humans at all.
Yes. Well, pigeons, being pigeons, didn't do too well with any humans. Both the Curries and the early settlers just loved a bit of pigeon
pie.
Loved
to eat them.
Yes. Yeah, and during the Depression, particularly, and after World War II, when a lot of soldier settlers came back, the pigeons suffered heavily from simply being eaten. And even when I first came to Australia in 1978 and went up to the tropical rainforest in North Queensland and did a bit of adventuring, you would commonly see shotgun shells on the forest floor right throughout the place.
Well, then we can get on. I'm interviewing Dr. Jim Shields, who's a senior ecologist and fascinating. Let's get on to kookaburras, because people who came here initially, I think the Italian immigrants used to call them ha-ha pigeon pies. They used to shoot the kookaburras, and because they laugh when they sing, they call them ha-ha pigeon pies.
They did indeed, and they are big, plump-looking birds. But I noticed that even our Italian friends haven't continued with the consumption of ha-ha pigeons, because, in fact, they're actually kingfishers.
Yes.
Great big kingfishers, and they have a carnivorous diet, and although they are edible, things usually taste much like what they eat.
Like they taste very fishy.
Yes. Australia, a weird and wonderful place, has a huge variety of kingfishers which have adapted to terrestrial environments. There are only two of them that fish very much. The kookaburra will decimate your goldfish pond, but because Australia is the driest continent in the world, they have adapted to terrestrial conditions.
Well, kookaburras, they kill snakes, don't they? They bash snake on a rock and kill the snake and then eat it, don't they?
Oh, indeed. And being kingfishers, their bill is not actually built for predation. They've adapted to the conditions, and so they use tools instead of having a ripping beak like a hawk or an eagle.
Oh, I see. So they use a rock.
Exactly. Exactly.
Now, I saw a bird the other day. I hope this is interesting to the people listening because it absolutely fascinates me. A bird turned up at the bird bath the other day, and it had a bright yellow chest. It nearly knocked me out. In fact, I've got a bathroom, and I was sitting on the toilet, and we have big windows looking out, and it just blew me away. I thought it had, a white chin and a white face and a sort of black at the top, and I looked it up, and it was a mangrove something or other.
Do you
know what I'm talking about, Jim?
I do indeed.
What is it? Tell us about it.
One of the members of the family, Pachycephalidae, which means thickhead.
Thickhead, yeah.
You probably noticed it had a big, boofy-looking head.
We could describe some humans like that, too.
Yes, well, remember, Pachycephalidae. And they are Australian endemic family, found nowhere else. All have really bright colors in the male. That would have been a male you're seeing. And quite drab colors in the females.
Mm.
And they're flycatchers.
Oh, they flycatchers?
Yep, that's what they are. The thick head has lots of muscles around the beak for snapping the beak shut and catching the
And do they live in the mangrove swamps?
They do. What you saw, the mangrove whistler,
yeah,
is a well-marked and discernible subspecies of the more common golden whistler.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the mangrove whistlers live in mangroves, of which you have some down the front.
Yeah.
And the golden whistlers live in the forests right throughout.
Well, what
right.
do they catch in the mangrove swamps? Because it's awfully muddy down there, Jim. There are crabs galore.
Yes.
But what about the flies?
Flycatchers is a bit of a misnomer. They should be insect catchers.
Insects.
Yeah, they catch. We did foraging studies on Australian birds. Just went out and saw what they did.
Yeah.
And golden whistlers gather most of their food by a capture maneuver we call the snatch, which is where they sit on a perch and look. You'll see them looking around, watching carefully, on a perch in the mangroves or in the forest. And when they see a bird, they look for an insect on the foliage,
yes,
or on a branch, and they'll fly to it and snatch it off a solid substrate.
Ah.
And this is the bell miners at your place drive out birds like the golden whistler, which catch a wide variety of insects.
Oh.
And
mosquitoes, probably.
Oh, indeed, yes.
So that's why we have mosquitoes, that's why we need to get rid of these blasted bell miners.
Yes, and we should say, this isn't just Helen and I disliking birds. As she said when we started, they're lovely birds themselves. It's just that there are too many of them.
And they're so territorial, and they're very aggressive, Jim.
Oh, yes.
Well, then we should talk about magpies. Tell people what a magpie is, Dr. Jim Shields, and how aggressive they can be in the spring.
I will indeed.
Yes.
Another fascinating Australian icon. A lot like Australians, the humans, the birds. But the magpie is a bird a little bit bigger than a domestic pigeon. It's black and white, and it's not really closely related to the magpies of the northern hemisphere, but it looks like them.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a beautiful warbling song, which there's some in my yard right this moment. I'm hoping if they call, I'll take the phone off my ear.
They say it's the most beautiful song in the world.
It is.
Song.
It is astoundingly beautiful.
Mm.
It really is.
Mm.
I may hang out a little bit for some of the thrushes in the northern hemisphere.
Yes, sounds like they're gorgeous.
They are indeed. Paul McCartney actually used the song in the thrush song, the blackbird, in his song of the same name. But the magpies, a lot of Australian birds, in fact, all of them we've talked about, have this communal breeding habit where they have several generations that hang around and look after the young. And the magpies are very, very defensive of the young of the year once their eggs are hatched, and will aggressively attack all humans that come anywhere near them.
Oh.
They do, and they're big enough, and they have a sharp bill. They can they are actually dangerous to not lethally dangerous, but can frighten and cut small children.
Well, my ex-husband was walking to work at the Adelaide Children's Hospital years ago across a park.
Yeah.
And he was walking along, and he suddenly heard this roar and a really sharp pain on his head, and a magpie had swooped down and taken out part of his scalp.
Ah, yes. you can indulge me with a magpie story.
Yeah, we'd like to hear your magpie story, Jim.
Well, and I spent 15 years in Sydney working at the research facility. They're in one of the leafy suburbs of northern Sydney, and I rode my bicycle to work.
Yes.
And the magpies are very clever. They know that if you're riding a bicycle, you can't stop and get them because you're riding a bicycle. And there was one pair of them that every year would attack me as I rode my bicycle past their nest. And one year I decided that I'm a wildlife biologist. I don't have to put up with this. I'm going to get through no matter what. And so I attached some wires, a coat hanger type wire, to my helmet and put little streamers of plastic flagging tape on those wires. And that worked for a while. That decoyed them away from it was hard for them to get at me, even though I was riding the bicycle. But pretty soon, being very clever, they figured out if they attacked from below, they could get at me still. And Bill, your husband, ripped a bit of out of my ear.
Oh, no!
If I wasn't from Kansas, where the state motto is too stupid to quit, if I'd have been smarter, I would have quit then. But I kept going, and I extended the coat hanger wires off the back of my helmet much longer, and eventually I had about three coat hangers with heaps of flagging tape.
It must have been quite a sight, Jim.
Well, that's exactly right. I was riding along Pennant Hills Road there in Sydney. I thought, well, this is working with the magpies. My only problem will be if I get reported to the authorities for insanity.
Yes, that's right.
large individual, almost nobody rode bicycles at those times, with fluoro clothing and what looked like a television antenna with plastic streamers, riding along the city streets.
Now, I just want to talk about crows, because I find they say crows are the most intelligent birds that there are. Would you like to talk a little bit about, and I remember living in Boston, the only thing that remained in Boston in the middle of winter were the crows, not here. This sort of lonely sound.
Yes.
But they are very intelligent, are they not?
They are incredibly intelligent. They're very long lived as a group.
How long?
In captivity, they could live up to 30 years.
What about in the wild?
In the wild, they frequently live 10. But that's a long time for a wild animal.
Is it? The other thing I want to talk about is that, for some strange reason, we had a thing called a cane beetle that attacked the sugar cane, and so they brought in from Brazil, I think, this thing called the cane toad, and it's a toad, the ugliest looking thing you've ever seen, that was supposed to eat the cane beetle, but it didn't, and it had no natural predators, and it spread all over the country, and this horrible, really big, ugly thing eats the snake eggs, and it eats the little frogs, and it's destroying our amphibians, our snakes, and all sorts of things. And the only thing that can kill it, and if you eat a cane toad, it's got two poison glands up near its neck, and so any species that eats it like a snake, they die. But the crows are smart. They turn the cane toad upside down and eat its belly so they don't get poisoned by the poison glands at its neck. Have you heard that, Jim?
Yes, yeah. I can't say about the mental process and that, but I have certainly observed crows, the Tauresian crow. I have observed them doing that with a cane toad.
Oh, with a cane, you have.
I have seen it with my own eyes. They certainly do it,
yeah.
And survive. And they're particularly devastating to medium-sized predatory mammals and reptiles.
Crows are.
The cane toads are poisonous, and they are really a lethal agent for the for mammalian carnivores. The northern quoll, one of your listeners probably have never heard of a quoll, quoll.
Mm.
It's a carnivorous marsupial, has a pouch and all that, and they look like carnivores. The only one that's relatively famous is, of course, the sad story of the thylacine or Tasmanian tiger,
mm.
which is...
Oh, that's a quoll, too.
Well, it's the largest member of the quoll family.
Oh.
It was about the size of a dog and had stripes like a tiger and was confined to the to Tasmania after the arrival, or in the last 4,000 or 5,000 years, theoretically, because the Aboriginals with dingoes arrived on the mainland, and it was outcompeted by the dingoes.
But we've got other quolls, the northern spotted quoll. That's the one you're talking about. They presumably eat the cane toads, and they're dying, right?
That is correct.
Isn't that tragic, Jim? We've only got about 4 minutes left. Would you like to give a little short soliloquy about how man has upset the balance of nature?
I would indeed. Helen, thanks for the opportunity. Thanks for your listeners giving us some time to talk about wonderful things.
Mm.
But my last 10 years were spent mostly as an economist in that I realized that most conservation problems can be solved if you have enough money. Cane toads and quolls problem, we know how to solve that if we had enough money to do so. Why don't we have the money? I got the opportunity to ask one of Clinton's advisors this once. It was a Texan. He said, Jim, if we build one or two less of them B-52 bombers, we might have enough money to do some conservation. And this guy was a pretty green rainbow person. And that's basically it. Our resources are devoted to things that we consider essential.
Or killing.
Killing other people.
Killing.
To prevent them killing us. And for things that we simply like. To me, the almost insane concept of continuing on these days with an economic system that is dependent on growth.
Mm.
This was rational when there were only a few of us humans on this planet.
Mm.
You had to have growth to grow. Now we're at the point where, in fact, we have too many people. I love people, like I love animals, but there are too many of us now, and to have too many people and an economic system that is based on constant growth is practically insane. My great friend Brian Check has an institute called the Center for Sustainable Economics, and that is the way out, I would think, is if we reward people for sustainability and preserving things rather than rewarding them for destroying them or killing each other.
Right, so growth is suicidal at this point in time on planet Earth. Growth in human population, growth in using all the natural resources on a finite planet, growth in the economic system, which is all about actually Russian roulette and gambling, as far as I can see.
Yep.
And we need people like you, Jim, to be politicians running the world, people who are scientifically literate, and that, I think, is one of the major problems that we have.
Well, that is also the case as well, in that most of the time, the people who have the scientific knowledge are unwilling or not capable of actually focusing on a benign solution. They're sometimes pretty good at pointing out problems, but usually the people that it ends up to ecologists or engineers. And the ecologists can easily define a problem, but few of them can devise a management system to make the problem better, whereas engineers will always tell you, yes, we can make it better, no worries. But in fact, they may have no idea of the consequences, and they could do well to adopt the credo of your profession, do no harm.
Yeah, well, look, on that wonderful note, Jim, we're going to yield to Jim Shields and end the conversation. We've run out of time, which was absolutely fascinating, as I knew it would be. Thank you so much for your inspiration and opening up new avenues of thought about our wonderful birds and wildlife.
You're very welcome, Helen. Thank you for everything that you've done for this planet, and keep the faith.
Thank you, Jim.
You're welcome.
My guest today on If You Love This Planet was Dr. Jim Shields, a senior ecologist with more than 30 years' experience in wildlife management. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. I really get turned on by birds. Anyway, we'll talk to you next week. Thanks for listening today. Bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.